coming up on this episode of FP Next.
I don't expect anything to happen quick. You know, you have new people getting into their roles. The Congress is going to be doing listening sessions again. So, going back to the point of considering input, and then you're going to have to craft a bill. So I don't think anything's going to happen in the first half of the year. But, you know, if we get that through, facing this another deadline here in September, I would think that, you know, that's probably our best chance to see a full farm bill would be sometime maybe in the summer months.
Everyone, welcome to this deep dive episode of FP Next, powered by John Deere, which is the kickoff of season 2. I'm your co-host for this farmer and rancher driven podcast, Sarah McNaughton Peterson, and I'm here with Kurt Arnes.
Hi, Sarah. Yes, we're powered by John Deere, so for all of your equipment and technology needs, see your local Deere dealer. Well, Sarah, here we are opening up season 2, and we're opening up to a national championship in your neck of the woods, right?
Yes, we are very excited. Have to give the shout out to our own NDSU Bison. Since last week, they won their 10th national championship down in Frisco, Texas. But everyone calls it South Fargo up here because it seems like we're down there all the time. And of course, SDSU Jackrabbits have been the championship game after defeating the Bison in the past couple years. And so we're pretty excited for how our home team has done and to have the championship trophy back up in North Dakota.
That's right. Yeah, what a exciting series to watch. And a lot of folks on the Northern Plains were watching that really closely. So it was kind of fun. Plus, you get to kind of hang that over Kevin a little bit over in Minnesota, right? So that's kind of fun, too.
It's always fun. I know he did text me and we both discussed at length that if there is one of the Dakotas in the championship, we are supporting the Dakotas regardless. But it's always nice when it's your alma mater, of course, like SDSU for Kevin and, of course, NDSU for me. Something new that listeners can expect to hear this season we're pretty excited about are quarterly updates from Weather 2020 founder, and he has a host of experience in meteorology and long-range outlooks, and he just offers something a little bit different than most farmers and ranchers are used to seeing from their weather apps.
Yeah, Gary Lezak with Weather 2020 is really interesting. He's got a wealth of experience. Shoot, we talk about weather almost every time that we have a podcast. And if you go to pretty much any coffee shop or diner in rural America, you're going to be hearing a little bit about the weather. So we just will have a really official and expert analysis here on FP Next. And Gary's going to provide that for us, you know, every once in a while, which I think will be great.
Absolutely. So with that, Gary, I want to thank you for joining us on FP Next. We're excited to have you join us and kick off the new season.
You know, it was named by the bloggers back in 2002. I had a very popular weather blog, 60,000 hits when a winter storm would be approaching, especially that's when people really get interested in the weather. And I was predicting these long range forecasts, you know, months out and getting them right. And after a year of experiencing it, the bloggers thought it should have a name. So they named it the LRC after my name, Lezak Recurring Cycle. So who knows what it will be named someday. But go back to 1962. I was born 1967, 1968, 5 years old, 6 years old. I was already obsessed and fascinated by clouds. And I grew up in Los Angeles where the weather was boring and I didn't know any better. And so I was just excited about the weather. I had an inspiration in this meteorologist that was on TV back then on KABC in LA. His name was Dr. George Fishbeck. And he would show cycling weather patterns or show the 500 millibar flow 18,000 feet above us and when a storm was coming into California to explain it. And I got obsessed with that. Then I graduate high school, go to University of Oklahoma, get my degree in meteorology, and I thought I would be on television, but I didn't know how to get there. That's a whole other story. And you get to, all of a sudden, I had a 38-year TV career. And then I left TV just to do Weather 2020. I have to get this technology out to the world. It's one of my goals, and we're doing it. 2025 is going to be a magical year.
Well, Gary, I know that you've had some really good success at predicting the hurricane season in particular, right? And so, you know, maybe you could tell us just a little bit about that, because obviously the hurricane season impacts all of us all across the Corn Belt and across farming states, you know, up here in the Northern Plains too. So if you could talk to us just a little bit about, you know, why that's so important.
Yeah, it is important for agriculture. In fact, the year that we really stumbled across the hurricane part of the cycling pattern hypothesis, the LRC, because, you know, the weather pattern across the United States through the mid-latitudes, as we call it, is cycling regularly. And that's what the LRC describes. And we'll talk more about that in a second. But in the tropics, a little bit farther south, there was a storm, a hurricane, I think it was Francis back in 2012, 2013, and it was heading towards what everyone thought was going to hit Florida. We used the LRC of what we knew at the time, that it was likely headed towards the Texas-Louisiana border. So we were already forecasting a completely different path than the National Hurricane Center was forecasting, and it was important. Because Kansas City, Kansas, Missouri, and parts of the Corn Belt were in a drought that year. And we predicted it's likely going to fall into this spot based on the LRC. And it ended up going right over the spot we predicted, came right up into Kansas, Missouri, produced 6 to 7 inches of rain. And so prediction, accurate predictions are important. But that's what we stumbled across at 10 years, 11, 12 years ago. Fast forward to this year. And now we know so much more. The technology is growing. And last year's pattern was about a 46 to 47 day cycle. This year looks like it's a little less than that, by the way. And there are these seeds for winter storms, for severe weather outbreaks, for tropical storms, droughts, floods. You can see these seeds in October and November, like weather seeds. And you can identify them, and some of them you can identify that will likely become tropical storms or hurricanes in the following summer. And so there were 5 landfalling storms in the United States this year. All 5 were hurricanes. And from Beryl to Debbie to Francine and Milton, and the other one was Helene, the worst one. All 5 were predicted weeks to months ahead on some level by using the LRC. So it is important. The hurricane forecast may be one of the biggest impacts, but predicting week by week rainfall for the farmers out there is of extreme importance. And that's what we've successfully done in the last few years.
I know. I want you to talk a little bit more about how exactly the LRC works like this. Because I know a lot of people maybe see like a 10 to 15 day forecast, and looking at this system, it can predict up to 300 days ahead, which I think is just fantastic because then farmers are able to pick different varieties if they're expecting there to be drought in their area. I know, Kurt, the Dakotas and Nebraska, our neck of the woods, have had varying levels of drought over the last few years, but talk a little bit about what makes this different than weather.com or any of those other weather predictors out there.
The other weather forecasts that others might use, maybe there's an app that you use or weather.com or whatever, they don't consider the biggest piece of the puzzle. The biggest piece of the puzzle is the LRC. And the LRC lets you know when and where and a little bit of the what will happen. So the others are blind. They don't know when and where there's going to be a winter storm. They don't know when and where there's going to be a hurricane. All right? They don't. So they use the other techniques out there, flawed models, El Nino, La Nina, ENSO, that's called the El Nino Southern Oscillation Index, the Arctic Oscillation. These are other influences, but they don't use this big piece of the puzzle, the LRC. So the LRC sets up every year, the cycling pattern sets up every year around October 5th, 6th, or 7th is the first day of each year's pattern. That just happens to be the day that it goes dark at the North Pole. So there may be some astronomical reasons for why it starts about then. I haven't put my finger on it. I'm not an astronomist. I'm a meteorologist. But let me just tell you, it's probably not just a coincidence, but it begins about October 6th or 7th. Then this year, it looks like it's going to be about a 6-week cycle this year. And what happened in the first cycle was very dry to start in the Corn Belt, very dry and mild to start in October. And everyone was concerned about, oh my gosh, there's going to be a dry season ahead. Then it got wet in November, and then it got dry again. So the pattern is cycling, and I've got my sheet here, and there is a stormy part of the pattern that's likely to return March 1st to March 28th, April 11th to May 5th, May 22nd to June 18th. So before summer settles in, there are three parts of the pattern that I think will get very wet. And so farmers can use this information to plan their planting, to plan the growing season. And then we can, you know, the sweet spot of the LRC is from planting to harvest. October is a wild card, but by then the harvest is just about done. So that's, there's a big advantage that the LRC is going to bring to agriculture, energy, obviously to transportation, shipping, interests along the Gulf Coast with hurricanes, and so much more. But that's what we're, that's what my life is all about, is bringing this to the world. We've got an AI project that's going to launch in about a month. I'll tell you more about next time.
You know, weather is something that Sarah and I talk about pretty much every episode. If you go to the coffee shop in pretty much any small town across America, what's, you know, the number one thing that they're sitting there talking about? And the idea, you know, we always say, we always joke that the weatherman can is good at telling us what did happen and where, but not so good at what is going to happen. And so, you know, your tools are so crucial to, you know, planning for farmers in particular. And I'm in irrigation country, so Nebraska is a very irrigated state. But for irrigation scheduling, you know, even though we're not, you know, we're not as reliant on dry land, but irrigation scheduling, you need, you want to save every drop of water you can, not run the pivot any more than you have to. So understanding when these patterns are going to hit are, it's just so important. Was that kind of in your mind, you know, as you were looking for this, you were looking for a planning tool, right? Something that was more reliable than what we were using. And obviously you've struck gold on that. Can you explain to us just a little bit about the thought behind, you know, that development, I guess, as you've progressed and improved and tweaked it over the years?
Yeah. You know, Kurt, that's a great, great question. And it's evolving. It's evolving today. I mean, in the last week or two, a storm system that was heading towards Kansas City with potential major snowstorm, ice storm, et cetera, this part of the pattern, I identified a few weeks ago in the first cycle and the second cycle. And then there are other influences, the AO, the Arctic Oscillation. It's dipping negative. And when it dips negative, you know, Arctic air may blast south. If you combine that knowledge with what we know about the LRC, remember the LRC predicts when and where and a little bit of the what, and then these other influences can help out with the what. So we were able to predict that storm weeks in advance. So way back in 2002, 2003, I was always saying, can't you see this looks like 50 days ago? Can't you see this looks like 50 days ago? And the bloggers demanded, Gary, why don't you start projecting forward 50 days and telling us what's going to happen instead of looking back? So I started doing that. And that's when a year later, they named it the LRC because I got the forecast right. And so we're learning more every year. I try to simplify it. It really is rocket science. Okay, this is complex. And I stumbled across it in 1987, 1988. I got a mural on my wall that shows that winter there was a 1-foot snowstorm in Oklahoma City. And then 50 or so days later, whatever the cycle was that year, there was another 1-foot snowstorm in Oklahoma City, a place that doesn't get snow. And I was like, wow. And then I looked at the weather patterns and they looked very similar. And so that's when I started to realize the whole weather pattern is cycling. We've cracked the code. There's a lot more to it. There's a lot more to share with you guys. But what do you guys think? I mean, you're into weather and farming and agriculture in Nebraska, Kurt, and Sarah, you up in North Dakota. You know what the statements about meteorologists and forecasting. I've always been accurate anyway, but what do you think? I mean, does this seem reasonable to you?
I know we were just joking about this. I was pre-Christmas shopping earlier in December, and the cashier asked me, oh, are you ready for this big snowstorm that's going to hit us? And I had no idea we were going to have a snowstorm, because I sometimes just don't even look at the weather because it's going to be an apocalypse. I feel like every time I look at the weather, and then we get 2 inches of snow. And up here in the Dakotas, of course, it's always the negative wind chills, the really bad ice storms, the snowstorms, and all of that. But it all, I think, feel like is so dependent on who you're talking to. And so I really think this is an interesting system, which tees me up for our next question of what do you think the snowfall is going to look like in the Northern Plains this year based on your system and kind of some more of the winter weather forecast for us in the north trying to stay warm?
Yeah, for the entire Corn Belt, the thing to monitor, it's really going to be fascinating because there is an influence from the El Nino Southern Oscillation ENSO. Okay, this year, it's just drifted into La Nina territory. And I can go over the details of La Nina. That'll take 10 more minutes. But just know we're into a La Nina at this moment, but it's not going to officially be a La Nina winter because by March, at least the models are showing that La Nina will fade and it will already be closer to what's called neutral between La Nina and El Nino. This is extremely important. I am expecting, based on what I'm seeing, that La Nina will loosen its grip on us. The reason it's dried out a little bit is because La Nina, that's the influence. It pushes precipitation patterns off to the east side of the Corn Belt, which means east of Nebraska, which means east of North Dakota, all right? But if La Nina loosens its grip, then what happened in November before La Nina strengthened, though there are 8 storms, as I told you in those date ranges, March 1st to March 28th, April 11th to May 5th, and May 22nd to June 18th, I'm expecting them to be deeper, which allows for Nebraska especially to get wet. North Dakota's on the edge this year of both. There may be some struggle in North Dakota to get above average rain. I think it's still going to come close to average, which is fine. So probably no major droughts developing. But more likely, there could be some problems for planting if it really hits hard between March 1st and March 28th. If it waits till that April time frame, we could get a lot of the planting in before it gets to the real wet conditions. But that's how it's looking right now. LRC combined with this grip. I don't like La Nina because it literally strangleholds the plains.
Yeah, I know. Well, we've had quite a bit of drought, even in eastern Nebraska, which is, you know, not quite as normal as high plains out west, but a lot of drought over the past couple of years in eastern Nebraska. Fortunately, we had a very dry harvest season, extremely dry, so much so that there were several combine fires and that kind of thing. But then we were able to get, like, I live in northeast Nebraska, we had about 2 inches after harvest. That was rain, not snow, which is sort of unusual for us. That really helped, but it's been pretty dry. Today it's snowing, but it's been pretty dry as far as winter goes. So your news is, you know, good news for my part of the region. How about, like, as we get into the south and the southeast, what do you see for those regions, I guess, because that's also an important part of our listenership here.
Right. The south and southeast, you know, obviously we'll look towards hurricane season, and I'll have our hurricane forecast guide out by the first week of March this year. The last 3 years, I'm proud of this. Barcelona Supercomputing Centers is a big organization in Barcelona, Spain. They've tracked 25 other organizations, private companies like Weather 2020, and also universities and government agencies that make forecasts, including the National Hurricane Center. And Weather 2020 has arguably been the most accurate hurricane season forecast 3 years in a row. And that's for the broad look. Remember, we're the only company that can predict when and where these hurricanes are likely to strike But on a broad scale, we were the most accurate 3 years in a row. So we'll have that out for the South and Southeast. There's a big ridge that formed. A ridge causes the jet stream to go to the north, so it allows for heat to build up. As we go towards May and June, I'm expecting that to build over the Southeast. It will increase severe weather risks from perhaps Tennessee and Mississippi westward, but it will warm up and dry out possibly in the Southeast as we go towards mid to late spring. The early spring may give them adequate moisture before that happens, but I'm expecting some drought possibilities of developing in the Southeast because of that ridge that the LRC says is part, a good part of this pattern.
Kind of throwing you another question here. So when we have talked with some of our past guests, especially those down in Texas, they talked about the amount of drought and the lack of water availability. And looking at the U.S. drought monitor, it looks like there's some exceptional drought down in parts of Texas, into Arizona, New Mexico, Nevada, and some of California, and then also up kind of in like the high plains states. How do you think these weather patterns will affect that state of drought? Do you think there's going to be a chance that drought lessens and they get some more water availability and some more rain? What is your model telling you?
I think Texas is going to be a challenge. The area that's been dry out there has been consistent. Remember, the weather pattern that's created that is cycling, and it's just the storm systems are penetrating there. So probably that area will be an expanding little drought area. The plains and the Corn Belt, these storm systems that I'm expecting would really make the drier areas isolated. So there may, if you're in an area that hasn't gotten a lot of precipitation, and we're talking, if you got to add up October, November, and December together, if it has been consistently been missing you, that's likely to continue. It's one of the things that the LRC is able to predict. What has happened is likely going to continue, but there are seasonal differences. For example, a winter storm coming in January, in July, the same pattern is not going to be a winter storm. We know that, right? It's not going to be a snowstorm in July, but it may produce a cold front, northwest flow, and thunderstorms. So the same pattern can have different results. But the plains, the isolated pockets of dry weather will continue, but broad, widespread drought, I'm not expecting.
So, Gary, you've alluded a little bit to the tools and the importance of Weather 2020. Could you tell us just a little bit about, you know, what farmers would expect, can expect, you know, when they use these tools and follow your forecasts, you know, why is that useful to them in their planning through the growing season?
Yeah, one of our tools for farmers, and a few dozen are using this tool right now. It's a great tool to have in your weather forecasting arsenal. You can have, if you're into analytics at all, it's great. If you just want to look and see which weeks are going to be wet and which weeks are going to be dry, you can get down to state level, to county level, to your farm, and get a forecast week by week is where the LRC really works well. That's called our Weather 2020 Vision Dashboard. That's a little more expensive. We also have, if you have an event, you're getting married, the Global Predictor, and that's just $5.99 a month. And you get the next 6 months forecast anywhere in the world. And that's on the Farm Progress site. You know, we got an example of that. But it's really a cool weather tool. There's nothing that exists like it in the world. And so we share these tools to provide insight and information for the end users. So for farmers, there's one product suite, and that severe weather forecast guide. We were 91% accurate last year in predicting when severe weather is going to happen. And the hurricane forecast guide, all the above are available. You can check it out on weather2020.com. But it's all, as we grow, farmers are using it, and we're getting really good feedback from it. It is useful and a valuable tool.
Awesome, Gary. Well, thank you so much for coming on and sharing all that great information. For our listeners, Gary is going to be joining us a few times a year, hopefully quarterly, depending on how scheduling works out and if there's any important storms coming up anyone needs to know about. But thank you so much. We're so excited to have you be a part of FP Next in 2025 and talking about Weather 2020. And I will be sending you an email if we you know, get some different winter weather up here than what you were predicting. Because I'm like, hey,
I'm
looking forward to it.
Sarah, Kurt, thank you so much. And then these dates, we'll have to check back in and see if those eight storms show up in that March 1st to March 28th range. There's another one, January 19th to February 16th. They're going to show up then too, but that grip from La Nina is still there for a few couple more months. Thank you.
Well, thanks a million, Gary. And we'll be watching those dates, and it'll be kind of fun to come back and check in with you and get feedback on how things turned out. And then we can look forward a little farther down the road too, into the growing season. So thanks a million. We sure appreciate you having you on today. So now we want to introduce Josh Baitke, who's our policy editor for Farm Progress. You know, Josh really has the pulse of a lot of the policy situations going on that are related to farming and ranching in America. It's kind of a moving target. It's something that is, challenging probably to follow, but Josh always says he loves his job. So that's why we have him on FP Next to kind of keep us up to date on farm policy. And with a new administration, there's going to be a lot of changes. So we sure want to welcome Josh on to FP Next today.
We just heard from Gary about some of those upcoming storms we can be expecting. And we have Josh, who just drove through one of those storms heading back down to Dallas, Texas from North Dakota. And Josh, tell us a little bit about how that weather was and how that drive was.
It made for a slow drive, Sarah, I can tell you that. And we weren't even through the worst of it, but we waited it out. And luckily, they got the roads clear just enough for us to make it home. So exciting as always.
Yeah, and all across the plains, I mean, this storm that you were driving through, it hit a little farther south than maybe is normal. And boy, it seemed like it dumped a pile of snow. You did go through Kansas, parts of Kansas, right? And so you drove through some of the worst of it, right?
Well, we actually had to skip Kansas. But, you know, that was the funniest thing, because normally we've been doing this trip for years, and normally you go south and the weather keeps getting better and better. And in this case, South Dakota was dry, half of Iowa was dry, and then boom, snow and ice. I think I heard, more than a foot or 15 inches in Topeka where you normally go through. So we managed to take a big detour through Kansas City and finally got out of it probably a little bit before Joplin, Missouri, and then it was smooth sailing the rest of the way. But yeah, definitely took us a little bit longer than normal.
As long as you made it nice and safe, right?
We did, just a little later than we wanted, but we made it nice and safe.
Well, talking about things taking a little longer than they're supposed to, we're going to talk about kind of all things Farm Bill, revisiting our conversation from November when you were on, talking about the election, some of the policy. Of course, we know a little bit more about what that policy might look like, but you know, the Farm Bill holds a lot of statutory power. It still has a little bit of something for everybody. We are still without a Farm Bill. And have you heard right off the bat any kind of extensions or updates or anything? I know you were just visiting with the Arkansas Senator John Bozeman. Kind of some little bit of an insight. What all did he tell you?
Well, you know, unfortunately, we're kind of back to square one in a way. You know, at the end of the year, just brief back up, we had the 2018 Farm Bill. It expired in September of 2023. It was reauthorized for another year through September of 2024, expired again in December, extended again through September of 2025 now. But the difference this time is now, we have a new congressional session coming in. So last year, the House did pass a version, a Republican-led version introduced by Congressman G.T. Thompson, the chairman of the House Ag Committee. We had a couple of proposals in the Senate introduced by then Chairwoman Debbie Stabenow and then Ranking Member John Bozeman. None of those proposals passed, but they were at least seen as kind of a starting point for negotiations. Now, with the new session of Congress, we're looking at, a bill has to be, reintroduced again. It has to go through the Congressional Budget Office, which scores it, says, does this meet certain budgetary requirements? And you have new members in the Ag committees, you have new members in the House and the Senate. They're all going to get their individual input on the bill. So, what's unclear at this point is, what bills that the Congress people are going to be negotiating over, because we're kind of starting from scratch. Now, obviously, we have a blueprint of what we may be looking at, but that's a big unknown until we see, what the members start voting on. Senator Bozeman, you mentioned I spoke to, he's going to be the chairman of the Senate Ag Committee. He's optimistic that we will get a bill this year, but he also admits there's a lot of hurdles that still remain between now and actually getting a new bill.
Yeah, and it seems like starting over maybe is it was what needed to happen to get something to to move along anyway. But I'm wondering, you know, are the sticking points going to be any different in this Congress than they were in the last Congress? Because there's agreement on a lot of the titles and some of the details, certainly. But the sticking points are still there, right? Just like we talked about last year when we visited with you.
Presumably that's correct. You know, you'll recall that, you know, the major sticking points a lot of the Democrats had with the Republican proposal is nutrition funding. And in the bill last year introduced by Chairman Thompson, there would have been changes to the what's known as the Thrifty Food Plan, which long story short, it's a formula that determines how much, like school lunches, you know, that nutrition aid, those funds are distributed. And what was done last time was the Republicans said, we're not cutting the funding, but we're saying any changes have to be cost neutrals. And the Democrats perceived that as a cut. And, you know, and it was a cut in the sense that the anticipated increase in school nutrition could now be allocated to other priorities since that was already in the Farm Bill budget. You know, another sticking point we had was funds from the Inflation Reduction Act, which, long story short, was a bill introduced by President Biden. It funded a lot of climate smart agriculture practices. The Republicans looked at that as they wanted to move those unused funds into the Farm Bill conservation title, and that would have permanently increased the amount of funds in the budget. But the sticking point with Democrats is they also wanted to change some of the climate smart practices that the IRA requires for those funds to be used. Now, interesting, at the end of the year, the Democrats at the last minute, as they were negotiating the bill to extend the Farm Bill, came around and offered to move those funds into the Farm Bill budget, so they would have permanently been in the Farm Bill. But there's a certain group of Republicans that are opposed to more spending that did not want to see the Farm Bill budget increase. So that proposal didn't pass in the extension. So that's going to be an interesting thing to look out for, because this was originally a Republican idea. You now have the Republicans in control of the House and the Senate, and obviously with President Trump coming in, this was originally their proposal to move it in the Farm Bill. But now, do they have the support to actually get that passed? And if they don't, will they try to pass it with more Democrat support, since seemingly now Democrats are more open to this idea, since those funds are now controlled by an executive branch, you know, led by President Trump?
So again, if you still don't have your crystal ball there, this question might be a little bit far-fetched, but so there's those 12 different titles we talked about a little bit already, then that's in the 2018 Farm Bill we're still operating under with that, as well as extensions. Are you expecting any kind of changes? Have you gotten any insight into maybe which of those titles might be expecting the most change?
I think the farm safety net, you know, the crop insurance and other risk management tools, those are going to be the biggest focus, because that's where the pressure is really getting on these lawmakers from farm states. Because again, like you said, we're working on, you know, programs that we created for the 2018 farm conditions. You know, you think back, that's before the pandemic, before inflation, before a lot of the issues that we're dealing with today. And, you know, farm leaders from, you know, across all the commodity groups, all of them, you know, agree that, you know, this is causing too much uncertainty for farmers. It's causing too much uncertainty for lenders. And really the pressure is growing to update those, you know, reference prices and other programs to better reflect today's farmer needs. You know, but again, that inherently is going to mean putting more money into those programs. And as always, the question comes back to, well, where does that money come from? And, you know, that when you boil it down to it, that's the same debate we've been having, you know, for the last 2 years since we've been talking about this. But you know, you have new members on the, you know, on the agriculture committees in the House and the Senate. You have new leadership on in the Democrat side in both chambers. So, you know, maybe that'll be the impetus to get some change, get some new ideas. But I think the pressure from constituents is really what's going to ultimately get this over the top.
And that's going to require Republicans and Democrats working together, because the farm state Democrats want this passed just as much as anyone else, I'm sure. So they will have to try and figure out somewhat of a consensus, I'm sure, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, number one, and that is one thing that the leaders from both parties have said, you know, this has to be a bipartisan bill. you know, that Senator Bozeman, Chairman Thompson, Senator Klobuchar is coming in to the is going to be the ranking member on the Senate Ag Committee, Angie Craig, who's going to be the ranking member on the House Committee. All of them have said they're committed to finding a bipartisan solution. But it's not just about the desire to do that. It's just the numbers, because if you look at the House, the Republican majority, they only have a majority by a few people. And it's even thinner at the moment because President Trump has selected some of the current representatives to be in his cabinet, and those seats have not been filled yet. And we already know going in there's a small group of Republicans that aren't going to vote for any bill that doesn't include spending cuts. And that's, you know, what most of the farm state legislators don't want. You know, they're not looking to cut the farm bill. We're looking to, you know, get more money for farmers. So, but passing something would then require some Democrat votes to replace those on the Republican side that presumably aren't going to support anything. It's similar dynamic in the Senate, but more so in the House, where it's, you know, it's guaranteed you're not going to get a farm bill through the House without at least some bipartisan support.
I was going to say, you kind of started talking a little bit about cabinet appointments, and, you know, we wanted to talk with you just a little bit about Brooke Rollins, the Trump administration's appointment for Ag Secretary. Such an important post when we're talking to our farmer and rancher readers and listeners, and maybe someone who wasn't necessarily on, you know, everyone's short list before the election, but I've heard a lot of positive comments about her coming into that post since then. Can you, you know, give us just a little bit of background and what you've learned so far?
Yeah, that was definitely a surprise choice. I mean, up until the day she was selected, she really wasn't one of the names you were hearing. She has an ag background. She grew up in Texas, about an hour and a half southwest of Fort Worth, from a farm family. She got a farm degree at Texas A&M University, obviously a big ag school. But then since then, her career has been more in law and in politics. She was involved in Texas politics for a number of years, you know, behind the scenes for former governor. And then in the first Trump administration, she held a number of positions with President Trump, including a domestic policy advisor at one point. When President Trump left office, she was involved in the Political Action Committee, actually founded that committee, you know, to promote ideas, you know, Trump philosophies. So the point I keep hearing from people about her is, number one, her nomination, it'll be a big surprise if she doesn't get confirmed, because there doesn't really seem to be any organized opposition to her. But, you know, I spoke with former Ag Secretary Mike Yohans last month. You know, he mentioned the importance of her having the trust and support of President Trump. You know, you mentioned, I spoke with Senator Bozeman today. He reiterated the same thing, just that, you know, this is somebody that the president will listen to, will take her counsel. So from that standpoint, that would seemingly be a good thing for agriculture, and that, you know, she has concerns and priorities that she definitely has the president's ear. But, you know, the unknown is, you know, since she hasn't held a cabinet level position before, we don't necessarily know her personal opinions or her, you know, philosophy or priorities. I think the assumption is, you know, they're going to align very closely with President Trump. So that remains to be seen. But yeah, there's really no red flags with Brooke Rollins or organized opposition. Just some unknowns in terms of just not being as, you know, public of a figure as, say, somebody like Secretary Vilsack, who's, you know, been in the public eye for, you know, 20 or 25 years. He's a little bit more of an unknown quality, but I'm sure we'll get to know her well pretty quickly here.
After she was nominated by President-elect Trump, a lot of ag organizations like the National Sorghum Producers, Corn Growers Association, National Grain and Feed Association, of course, the American Soybean Association, National Farmers Union, a lot of people were really excited to see her on-farm experience and kind of her background in ag. And kind of like what you're saying, they're cautiously optimistic and excited to see somebody with that farm background back in that position. But turning a little bit from that position, do you want to share a little bit about what you've heard of, like, the undersecretaries and kind of the important role that they play?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, I think, you know, the Brooke Rollins nomination or confirmation is going to come first, and then these other positions will fall into line. But like you said, you know, the undersecretaries are the ones that really, you know, run a lot of the day-to-day operations. You can look at USDA, you know, like a major corporation with multiple assets, and it's these people running the various assets of the company that ultimately make it go. So I think, you know, I honestly have not heard a ton individually about, you know, the nominees that have been announced so far, and we haven't heard them all yet, I don't believe. But, you know, I think, you know, kind of in this has just kind of been the philosophy with a lot of these nominees in general. The president is choosing people that that he trusts that will presumably carry on, you know, his priorities. So I think, you know, if there's one thing we expect, it's people that are aligned with his belief. I think, you know, hearing people from the Trump team talk, you know, one of the things they wish they had done differently in his last term was to, for him to bring in people that were on board with him. Cause, you know, in hindsight, a lot of people he brought in, you know, being new to government were experienced, but they didn't necessarily share his vision. And that created a lot of tension within the cabinet. We saw a lot of people come and go throughout his term. You know, this time it seems like his team has done a pretty thorough job of bringing in people that are going to be committed to the goals that President Trump has in mind. You know, the key obviously is when he assumes office here, what those goals and priorities will look like, which, you know, is kind of still, you know, what we're waiting to find out. But I think all the nominees he's bringing in will basically be carrying through whatever priorities he puts in place without a whole lot of dissension.
So Ag Secretary is the big one that we worry about, but about a lot of the other cabinet posts that will also be important to agriculture and a lot of other federal agencies. One that farmers get to talk about a lot and maybe discuss and debate a lot is EPA. And so, you know, from EPA and some of the other cabinet positions, you know, what do you see a general sense of coming for the new administration, and how does that connect and relate to farmers and agriculture in the field?
I think, and this is no surprise to anybody, from EPA, you're going to see a lot more emphasis on deregulation, on taking business perspective first. You know, the critics of the Biden administration, will tell you that, you know, the rules are overly burdensome, that in some cases, they would even say unrealistic. So I think you're going to see a reexamination of a lot of rules and policies put in place, you know, anything from, you know, pesticide regulation to clean fuel regulations, things like that. You're going to see a reexamination of these policies and changes that favor the private sector, favor business, and don't necessarily put the environmental part first in the same way that the President Biden's administration did. And that's not to say, you know, there aren't going to be environmental protections and things like that, but it's a completely different approach and philosophy. When you have the Trump administration, and he's the president-elect has made no secret of that he plans to cut regulation. He believes those things are holding businesses back and misguided. Obviously, President Biden supporters would disagree with that, but I think he's been pretty clear with that, and so we can expect a little bit more of a pro-business, less regulation approach at EPA and with the federal agencies in general.
I know earlier this, or I guess last year, now it is officially 2025, the North Dakota Grain Growers had a lot of officials from DC with the EPA come out and have a lot of really good visits and conversations with farmers, especially talking about, you know, the chemical use, the pesticide use, I always feel like is a big topic when the EPA is involved. Have you heard from any farmers or organizations on what the feeling on maybe chemical restrictions for farmers might be?
Yeah, I think they're excited about the administration coming in and loosening some of those regulations. You know, as you mentioned, there's been a lot of concerns that, you know, some of these regulations have not been thought through, that, you know, whether it's, you know, the use of dicamba, other things like that, that the regulations don't follow the science, in their opinion, that, you know, they're overly burdensome, they're not taking into account new data. I think you're going to see an EPA that is much more open to listening to the industry's concerns and in fact, you know, maybe and making that more of a priority than the Biden administration did. So I think, you know, there's a lot of excitement among the groups that are most adversely affected by these regulations.
So right before the beginning of the year, American corn growers got kind of a win with trade with Mexico. And, you know, on the trade side, certainly President Trump has made no secret of, you know, some of his plans, and I think it's caused some consternation for some, but others, you know, feel like it's high time, that kind of thing. So have you gotten any sense in your visiting with lawmakers and other policy developers, you know, over the past month or so, have you gotten any sense as to where the, you know, where we're headed on some of this, you know, on the trade direction, I guess, at least?
You know, I think from what I'm hearing, there's a concerted effort to not want to get on the president's bad side. You know, there are concerns, you know, like we talk about tariffs, you know, and how that'll negatively impact trade. There's some wariness, but there's also kind of a wait and see approach with, we don't know how they're going to be implemented. You know, how is he going to implement this and still protect farmers and other business interests? And then I think the other thing that I hear that lawmakers on the Republican side and a lot of these industry groups say is they've been very critical of the way the Biden administration has handled international trade. They feel there's not been enough work done to expand other markets, you know, particularly in light of, you know, trying to become less reliant on China and then, you know, some of the resulting trade wars. So I sense a lot of optimism in a renewed effort to increase trade deals with other countries and trade deals that they feel are more beneficial to American farmers. And I think they're willing to give as far as tariffs, when we see exactly how, you know, because we know we've been through the Trump administration before. We know, you know, some things are said and they're not going to be what the final policy are. It's more almost from a negotiating standpoint. Like you throw out, I'm going to impose 100% tariff. So really that's a threat. And then behind the scenes negotiates and a deal is made. And I think a lot of these groups are willing to see, let's see what deal is made before we get concerned, because they do believe, you know, this is also, maybe he's negotiating from a position of strength, and we're going to come up with a deal that is beneficial for American farmers and American businesses. So generally speaking, I'd say, you know, optimistic, but still, you know, some wariness, particularly on the tariffs, because, you know, typically, you know, Republicans have been the party of free trade. And, you know, but as we've seen, the political alignment has completely changed the last 8-10 years. So, you know, those old coalitions are changing, and, you know, people are willing to consider ideas that once, you know, they would have been opposed to, in hopes of we're going to get something that achieves the national security goals and achieves the job creation goals in the country, but doesn't hurt our export markets.
I know there's a lot of talk too, because of course Mexico is our number one trade partner, but our neighbor to the north, and if you're in North Dakota like I am, it's like 20 minutes to the north, right? And he had doubled down talking about his threat to impose tariffs there too. I think one thing that's really interesting that maybe a lot of people don't know, because I just learned this as well, is the amount of crude oil that we get from Canada, because they produce more than they can refine and we're able to refine it here. What do you think that's maybe going to look like? You think it's kind of like the same thing of making those deals and under the table kind of discussions behind the scenes?
Yeah, I mean, I think at the end of the day, that's what a lot of this is just, you know, trying to get in a better bargaining position and then being able to say, see, I threatened to do this, and now we have this better deal. You know, President Trump has made no secret that he wants to increase energy production. You know, I think a lot of that's, you know, focused on domestically, but you know, I think we'll definitely see that. And one of his goals is to, you know, lower energy prices, increase production. So, yeah, I think that's, you know, part of his overall policy philosophy. I mean, and we'll see how it plays out.
I know I've interviewed United Soybean Board directors over the years, and during the Trump years, their thoughts about how we dealt with China kind of moved into the idea of expanding our trade partner base. In other words, not, you know, just as you said earlier, not relying so much on China and trying to open up new markets in other areas, because they felt like that would be, you know, using that opportunity to kind of broaden things out, and that would be better overall for trade, for especially for agriculture. And it seems like some of that has, you know, has kind of played out, I think, too. So I guess, you know, it's a kind of a wait and see deal, right?
It is, you know, and the other thing is, you know, we focus a lot on the tariff policy of Trump, but you know, keep in mind that a lot of these policies, that the tariff policies that President Trump implemented, were kept in place by President Biden. You know, and President Biden imposed his own, you know, tariffs on certain Chinese goods. And, you know, so it's about finding that balance. Like, you know, there's a recognition that, yes, they're, you know, one of our biggest trading partners. We need them for a lot of things. But there's also a recognition that there are some security threats. And there's also, you know, there's, you know, concerns about flooding the market with inferior products, undercutting prices. Those are all valid concerns, too. So I think, you know, what once was kind of a cut and dry pro this, anti this is really has really changed. And, you know, and just like anything else, it's a complex issue that requires complex solutions. We're really just in the beginning of, you know, figuring out what will this trade relationship look like long term.
So then, Josh, with all of that info, it's kind of, it seems like, again, if you don't have a crystal ball, it's kind of a wait and see. What are you expecting big picture overall for the Farm Bill in 2025?
I think, and this is just purely me guessing, you know, I think hopefully by summer we'll have an idea of a more formalized bill, you know, introduce some proposals that we can really work off of. And then, you know, with the pressure there, you know, with the new makeup in Congress, and if, with a little bit of luck, we'll get something passed before September. I don't expect anything to happen quick. You know, we're going to, you have new people getting into their roles. I've already heard that we're going to be doing the Congress is going to be doing listening sessions again. So, you know, going back to the point of taking, you know, considering input, and then you're going to have to craft a bill. So I don't think anything's going to happen in the first half of the year. But, you know, if we get that through, you know, and we facing this another deadline here in September, I would think that, you know, that's probably our best chance to see a full farm bill would be sometime maybe in the summer months, if I had to guess.
Well, thanks a million, Josh, for being on FP Next today. And we always love catching up with you because, gosh, this policy stuff keeps moving so fast. It's just hard to keep up. And you know, I don't envy your job at all in keeping track of everything, especially with a new administration coming in. But we sure want to thank you for joining us. And know you're on the speed dial, so we'll have you back on very soon, I'm sure.
Hey, I love what I do. There's never a dull moment, and happy to talk to you guys anytime. I'll always enjoy it.
Well, Kurt, I think that about wraps it up for this deep dive episode of FP Next, powered by John Deere. Again, we want to thank Gary and Josh for joining us today to kick off season 2.
And to our listeners, we want to thank you for tuning in to this season of FP Next, allowing us into your tractor cab, your truck, on your farm, in your shop, and in your fields. We want to take a moment to share a thank you to John Deere for powering FP Next and allowing us to bring you more of these episodes and topics to farmers and ranchers across the nation. A special thank you, as always, goes out to our digital production and marketing team members who put in a lot of work with us. And if you want to be sure not to miss any top stories, sign up for our Farm Progress Text Blasts, which bring the hot stories right to your inbox.
You can sign up for those text alerts by texting FARM, F-A-R-M, to 20505. Be sure to follow Farm Progress on social media to stay up to date with ag news and more, and check out the digital edition of your regional publication at farmprogress.com. And stay tuned for our next episode, where we'll visit with Whitney Hagwood of Delta Farm Press, who covers the home state of this year's Super Bowl, and we're going to get into talking a little bit about the role agriculture has on this big day in sports.
So yeah, sports and agriculture. So that episode should be a lot of fun and very timely too for all of our listeners.
And like Kurt mentioned, you can follow along with FP Next by listening and subscribing on your favorite podcast platform or YouTube or Farm Progress Online. And be sure to leave us a review if you enjoy the show.
Sarah, you always say 5 stars or nothing.
Definitely. And remember, if it's agriculture, your friends at Farm Progress have you covered. Here's wishing you high yields and good weather. We'll see you next time.